From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And it has been a wild ride. And at this hour, the race for president is still too close to call. Here's the latest. Michigan's Secretary of State said today they're still counting tens of thousands of ballots. They could have an unofficial tally by the end of the day. Michigan is one of a number of states, including Wisconsin, Nevada, Pennsylvania, still counting. And Pennsylvania State Attorney General Josh Shapiro said the results could take days. Here he is on ABC News.
All across Pennsylvania, clerks from our communities are making sure that these ballots are counted. There's still a lot of vote left. This is way too early in the process.
And you heard Robin mention Wisconsin is one of those states that we are watching. It's one of the key states that has yet to finish tallying votes, but there's a lot happening there right now. It would only be the fourth time in a presidential election that the vote in Wisconsin could be decided by less than 1%. And that's where we're finding LaToya Dennis. She's a reporter with WUWM in Milwaukee. Hey, LaToya.
Good to be here.
So let's talk about the numbers first. What's the latest tally, and what counties and areas of the state are you watching closely right now?
Yeah, basically almost 100% of the vote is in and has been tallied. And there's about a 25,000 vote difference with Biden leading at this point. Now, there is an area right outside of Madison, Wisconsin, which is in the western part of the state, where there are still some outstanding votes. And basically, we're waiting on those to come in. But in that area, which is called Richland, Trump is leading there by about 54%. Well, he's leading by about 10% of the vote.
Okay, so if I'm clear what you're saying, the majority of the votes have been tallied, and they're showing that Biden does have a narrow lead.
Yeah, a very narrow lead. It would definitely be within that 1% that's needed to force a recount here.
Yeah, I want to talk with you a little bit more about the recount, because we've seen that before in Wisconsin. What's the overall mood, though, right now as we continue to wait for final results?
Oh, everyone's nervous, right? Yeah. Democrats are asking if Joe Biden did enough here because, you know, in 2016, the concern was that Hillary Clinton didn't visit Wisconsin after the primary. She didn't come here, and President Trump was able to flip the state. Biden did come to Wisconsin. He's been here three times, but only once in the last month of the campaign, and that was on the Friday before the election, so this past Friday. And so the question is, you know, did the Biden campaign do enough here? And when it comes to the Trump campaign, they gave it all they had, you know, and so they're just hoping that they get that turnout, the result that they want here.
Yeah, I mean, based on that, do the numbers seem to align with what you've seen as someone who's been covering the state of Wisconsin all of these months?
I laugh because the answer to that is absolutely not, right? The polls leading up until today, especially one that we rely a lot on, the Marquette poll, had Joe Biden with a 5% lead across the state. And obviously that's not the case at this point. It is a very thin margin right now.
Let's talk a little bit about a recount and what that could look like.
Mm-hmm. Well, basically, a recount won't happen until the votes have been finalized, and that's not scheduled until December 1st. So a recount would be a few weeks out at this point, and basically it can only happen if the losing candidate is within 1% of the winner.
Okay. What are some of the top state Democrats and Republicans saying about the race so far?
You know, it's been quiet. I was just, before I logged on with you guys, I was just checking like our email boxes and everything. There is nothing. And I'm actually quite surprised by that. I was expecting, you know, calls for victory already. But it's been quiet from top state leaders. It has not been quiet from the people of the state, though, right? There are people who are saying no matter who wins, we vow to continue the fight for social justice. We vow to make sure that every single vote is counted. And, you know, we vow to push on.
LaToya, I want to go back to what you were telling us about the tally and the numbers. I mean, can you explain for us, though? I mean, Wisconsin expanded its mail-in voting this year. I understand that state law requires that officials have all of the initial results by 4 p.m. Central Time today. Are they likely to meet that deadline? Does it even matter? I'm just thinking about all of the votes that have yet to be counted that were early votes.
You know, the question, the answer is we don't know if it matters. So state statute does say that all votes need to be tallied by 4 p.m. of the day following the election. If you don't meet that, the Supreme Court was asked to come in and clarify what happens, and they did not do that. So basically, the advice that's being given is that count until the count is done, do your best, make sure it's accurate, and get it in whenever you get it in. But hopefully you make that 4 p.m. deadline because you don't want to give anyone a reason to challenge anything.
That's Latoya Dennis. She's a reporter at WUWM in Milwaukee. Thank you so much for this update.
Thank you.
Well, meanwhile, early this morning, President Trump falsely claimed a victory and falsely said the mail-in ballot counting was a fraud. The Biden campaign fired back then that all votes should be counted. And today, Joe Biden's campaign claimed he's on track to win. NPR political correspondent Scott Detrow joins us now from Washington. Hi, Scott.
Hey there. I'm actually in Wilmington, where Joe Biden is expected to speak again at some point today, and spoke last night after midnight, saying he felt confident, but it's going to take some time to count these votes.
Excellent. Excellent. So you're poised to bring that to us. But as you know, both men have a path to victory. It may be narrow, and it leads to very specific states at this point. We just heard about Wisconsin. So what do we know about what's happening with vote counts in Michigan, Pennsylvania?
Well, I think it's fair to say that right at this moment, unless we see substantially different data than what we've been seeing and what we're expecting to keep seeing, I think Joe Biden has a much better path to victory, a much clearer path to victory right now. You were just talking about Wisconsin. I think one notable thing is that former Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker was saying on Twitter today that he thinks it's really, really hard to overcome a 20,000 vote deficit. Michigan, we are seeing more and more votes come in over the course of the day from key big Democratic areas, you know, the county in and around Detroit. And Democrats feel very confident they are going to expand their lead there and that Joe Biden will win Michigan, possibly handily. There is a very narrow lead that Biden has. It's like 8,000 votes in Nevada, but we expect to see more mail-in ballots coming in tomorrow that could expand that lead. If all of those leads hold, Joe Biden would have the 270 votes he needs in the Electoral College to be president. The last state to talk about very quickly is Pennsylvania. Biden is down by 500,000 or so votes right now. It's a big margin. But Pennsylvania's Secretary of State says there are millions more mail-in ballots to cast, and we know that those have been breaking pretty heavily for Democrats.
Well, because this is how it works, Scott. I mean, this was predicted that President Trump would get much of the walk-in vote from yesterday, but the mail-in vote was going to go largely to Democrats. And analysts can see where the counties are that are reporting, and they can see whether those counties, even the cities within the counties, are blue or red. And they are seeing, as you said, it's looking like some of those mail-ins that are still being counted are coming from those areas. But what about the president's claims of fraud? You know, in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, officials aren't even allowed to start counting mail-in ballots in some states until after polls close. How are other Republicans reacting to him saying that this is fraud?
Yeah, and let's be very clear again, because we can't say it enough. This is legitimate vote counting that's happening as planned. These are votes that were cast on or before Election Day, and they're just being counted, you know, slowly. And it's not really that slow to still be counting votes the morning after an election, you know. I thought one thing that was interesting is that you've seen a few Republicans mildly distance themselves from this. You saw a Florida Senator Marco Rubio saying that, you know, the vote count will be in when all legitimate ballots are counted and that counting takes time. I just mentioned that Scott Walker is basically conceding that Trump cannot win Wisconsin at this point in time. We just heard for the first time from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who looks like he's going to remain Senate Majority Leader. He kind of walked down a middle line saying that he wasn't concerned about Trump's claim of victory, saying that, you know, people declare victory. Of course, Trump wasn't saying, I think I probably won. He was absolutely declaring victory with a lot of votes remain to be counted, and that's two different things. But McConnell also made a point to emphasize that we will have final vote count outcomes in states, and that might take a few days, and to look at this once the final vote outcomes are in.
Well, I just say Marco Rubio went a little further, saying taking days to count legally cast votes is not fraud. Chris Christie also said that. So Republicans apparently aware of this moment. But you mentioned the Senate. Just real quick, in about the minute we have, how are the congressional races looking in the Senate in particular?
Boy, this is a place where Democrats wildly underperformed their expectations. And I think it's fair to say a lot of Democrats are shocked. They are going to lose seats in the House of Representatives after thinking they were going to gain some. Democrats will still have control of the House, but it's a lot narrower. And at this point in time, it seems like there's really almost no way that Democrats retake the Senate majority after feeling like they were going to win a ton of races in places like Iowa and North Carolina and Maine. It looks like Republicans are going to have a shockingly better night than expected and hold their Senate majority. And if Biden wins the White House and Republicans control the Senate, it's a very different scenario than what Joe Biden talked about over the course of this campaign for what he wants to do.
Yep. Well, this is what we're watching. NPR political correspondent Scott Detrow, again, poised to bring us Joe Biden's comments. His campaign has said he may be making them. So, Scott, thanks so much to you.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
We have been here as a country before, waking up the day after Election Day without knowing who won. In 2000, George W. Bush versus Al Gore. Florida's deciding electoral votes were in question because the race was so close. State law required a recount, and that led to famous pictures of voters, counters, squinting at hanging chads, these little pieces of paper hanging off ballots. Were they meant to be punched through as a vote or not? It took months, went all the way to the Supreme Court. Bush won. We woke today to no winner, but because of the enormous flood of mail-in ballots. Biden saying the counting should continue. President Trump falsely claiming victory and making this false charge about counting ballots.
This is a major fraud in our nation. We want the law to be used in a proper manner. So we'll be going to the U.S. Supreme Court. We want all voting to stop.
But in several states, it's the law that voting can only start as late as Election Day. Julian Zelizer is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. Julian, we know this was a false claim, but your thoughts about a president, a sitting president, making it from the East Room of the White House?
It's outrageous. What we're talking about now is just counting the legitimate ballots that have come in, that are coming in under deadline. And to have the president in the middle of this try to stop it and issue rhetoric suggesting somehow this is fraudulent is really a form of campaign interference we shouldn't see from the president of the United States. It was expected. It's setting up a legal challenge, but it's shocking nonetheless.
Well, but how shocking? I mean, have we ever seen it?
Well, obviously, many people felt that during the 2000 recount that you were talking about, after the ballots were counted and then they were being contested, that the Bush campaign was excessively aggressive, although it was done through his team, like James Baker, in trying to stop the recount. But this is doing it in the middle of the actual election and just talking about the normal counting of the vote. This isn't what we saw just a few years ago.
And it's sounding like we haven't ever seen it before that. It just feels like every time you have come on recently, we ask you, have we ever seen this before? And you say no. Can you put what's happening now into historical perspective?
Yeah, I mean, there's two stories. One is what the president did, and I think it's fair to say this is pretty unprecedented, what we're watching and the way he's trying to handle this. The election itself actually fits in what we've been seeing in the last few decades, even though we like to think there's going to be a lot of drama. A lot of the elections since 1984 tend to be settled in battleground states. It's often very close. Sometimes there's one or two states that flip. And it comes down to narrow slivers of voters. And that's exactly what we're seeing play out. The kind of partisan fault lines have held in place despite some predictions of a landslide. And so now we're just waiting to see where the votes fall. And then after that, whether there are any challenges or recounts that would take place in specific states. So in some ways, it's very predictable. What the president did wasn't, but the rest isn't that much of a shock.
Well, but it's probably even more important, you know, what's happening culturally in this country. I want to put aside the numbers for just a second. We've got NPR's Kelsey Snell standing by. She's going to be talking about some of these congressional races. We'll go back to the numbers. But meantime, Julian, we have a country, doesn't matter what President Trump said and how you might view it. You know, half of this country, just about, is embracing him. And you said that this election would be the reckoning, about a reckoning the country is having with Trumpian conservatism and the Republican Party. Yes, Biden is closing some of the gaps as the day goes on. But what do you think we found through this election about Trumpian conservatism?
I mean, watching it last night, my reaction was a lot of the country supports it. They're fine. They're enthusiastic about this kind of Republican politics, and it's not going away soon. There's all this talk, will this election cause a soul searching for Republicans? And the returns I'm seeing for the presidency, for the Senate, where Republicans did pretty well, shows that a lot of the country is on board with what the president is doing. So that's tough sledding if there is a Biden presidency, because he's have to contend with that landscape.
Can you think, give us other times for that? And of course, we had a civil war. But, you know, other times when, you know, FDR had huge battles, other times when a president has come in, and this is if Biden does come in, of course, when the country is so evenly divided.
Well, sure. Look, George W. Bush came in under those circumstances, and he came in under circumstances where many people felt that he didn't even win the election legitimately, that it was a Supreme Court decision. That model's interesting in that as things unfolded, Bush was able to do a lot, in part because of 9/11 and the aftermath, and he was able to get reelected. But the electorate never really united around him, and it remained deeply divided as it is today. So you can govern under those situations, but the fault lines are deep.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the Vietnam era.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't as clearly partisan, those divisions, so the parties were very divided and it was a lot messier. But in terms of a nation, that's absolutely true. By 1968 and the election that brings Richard Nixon into office, the country is very, very far apart on some very basic issues, from war overseas to culture and social norms here in the United States.
And what kind of a reckoning, in just less than a minute we have, has this been for the Republican Party? What does it mean for the Republican Party?
Not much. It's an awakening, I think. Any Republican who didn't think this is what the party is about now will see this is what the party is about. President Trump very much represented the GOP in 2020. And as you said, there's a lot of support for that GOP. So I don't think there's going to be any changes in the near future internally.
Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. Thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Well, meanwhile, it looks like the Senate is going to remain in Republican hands, or as Lindsey Graham said in his victory speech in South Carolina, all you liberals in California and New York, you wasted a lot of money. Graham and some other Republican incumbents faced strong, well-financed Democratic contenders and fended them off. In the House, Republicans picked up a couple seats, but Democrats kept their large majority there. So let's take a closer look with NPR's congressional correspondent, Kelsey Snell. Kelsey, hi.
Hi there.
So the Senate had seven toss-up races, all Republican incumbents. Most of them have won. Let's see, Kelly Loeffler, David Perdue, both in Georgia, Joni Ernst in Iowa, Steve Daines, Montana, Susan Collins, Maine, Tom Tillis, North Carolina, as we mentioned, Graham, South Carolina. What are you taking away there?
Well, I should say that we were actually watching about 14 races as competitive races, and that Kelly Loeffler has not won in Georgia, and Tom Tillis has not won in North Carolina, nor has Susan Collins in Maine.
Okay, I was given the wrong list. Sorry about that.
Just so people are clear, Joni Ernst in Iowa did win. So did Steve Daines in Montana, Lindsey Graham in South Carolina. But we are still watching races in Maine and North Carolina, and particularly in Georgia, we're watching two races that may go to runoffs in January. Basically, this is a situation where Democrats were hoping to fight Republicans on their home ground. They wanted to pick up seats in places that ordinarily wouldn't be competitive. They hoped that Vice President Biden would carry many other Democrats across the finish line. And they were also looking at huge cash advantages, sometimes record-breaking cash advantages, in many of these states. And they were hoping to turn that what they expected to be a wave for Democrats into, you know, a moment to to make inroads into particularly southern states where Democrats haven't had a lot of success in the Senate. That has not materialized in the way that Democrats had hoped. And right now, the path for Democrats is narrowing, though they have not lost the possibility that they could win some additional seats. Even Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell earlier today said that he, as the way he framed it, he didn't know if he was going to be running the offense or the defense next year. And much of that will come down to races that are still to be decided, particularly North Carolina, Maine, Georgia.
Yeah. Okay, take a look at the House.
In the House, Democrats there also, you know, underperformed on promises that they made, that they were expecting a gain of in the neighborhood of 5 to 15 seats. Pollsters were attributing potential gains to them in that range, but that just has not materialized. In fact, at this point, it looks like Republicans are set to pick up several seats in the House. You know, I've been looking very closely at races, open seats, particularly in a few states, Virginia, Indiana, and Texas in particular, where, you know, Democrats felt that they had opportunities to pick up additional seats beyond kind of the high watermark of the majority that they had going into this election. Now, those seats really didn't break for Democrats, and they also lost seats in South Florida. It has been a very difficult day for Democrats, and they are definitely doing some internal searching to figure out how they read things so incorrectly.
And one thing we just want to make sure we ask you, we now have a QAnon supporter in Congress, Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, the Republican. President Trump had praised her. What does that mean about the ideological makeup of the incoming freshman class? Does it mean anything? Is she a one-off? What does it mean?
She is not a one-off, but there are, I mean, this brings up questions about who the Republican Party will be in the House. They have trended closer and closer to President Trump in terms of their rhetoric, and they've become, they're just a very different party than they were in just a few years ago. And it will be an interesting transition to see the way that their leadership manages this transition.
NPR's congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell will keep following, as you said, the remaining races that are still being fought over. Kelsey, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Typically, the stock market hates uncertainty. In spite of having no clear presidential winner yet, it opened higher, possibly because investors already priced the uncertainty of this weekend, or because they see different benefits in the candidates. 4 more years of President Trump could mean looser regulation, and 4 years with Biden could mean more stimulus. Mike Regan is here to break it down for us. He's senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hey, Mike.
Hi, Tanya.
Well, obviously, this is a dynamic situation, but how is the market reacting so far to having no president yet?
Well, so far, so good. I mean, the S&P 500 is actually looking like it might put in its best post-election day in history. And I think you're absolutely right about that uncertainty. Overnight, we saw some pretty bad weakness in the futures market when investors were very much uncertain about which way the race would go. It looked like it might be too close to call. But this morning, I think investors woke up and they saw that it looks more and more likely that Biden will be able to squeak out a win. And at least for the moment, and that's important to say, at least for the moment, it seems like that uncertainty has subsided a little bit for investors.
Oh, that's interesting. I want to talk a little bit about the Senate, which also is in play here, because it could determine what kind of stimulus measures get passed if the Senate remains Republican controlled, as it's looking at like it may do. Could that put a damper on some of the early enthusiasm we've seen in the markets in recent days?
So the reaction from many investors today is that the gridlock of a divided Senate might actually be a good recipe for Wall Street under a Biden presidency, because it would make Biden less likely to be able to roll back some of those deregulation efforts you talk about and the big tax cuts under the Trump administration. But look, Wall Street is a very fickle beast, and I think you're right that the focus will turn almost immediately to that stimulus issue and what we can expect. Before the election, a lot of investors and strategists I talked to were very nervous about this exact scenario of a divided government. So I think we need to see how this wait and see how this plays out over the next few days, especially because there's a Federal Reserve meeting tomorrow and a press conference following it that investors will very much be focused in on to see if they have any sort of reaction to the economic outlook in lieu of the election.
With the minute I have with you, I want to delve into something else. We're seeing from some of these early exit polls that the New York Times reported that voters backed Biden in every income bracket except those making between $100,000 and $200,000 a year. Lower and middle income class voters seem to be leaning so far towards Biden, and families making more than $200K also going towards Biden. But that $100K plus range strongly towards Trump. Any insight into why?
You know, Tanya, it is surprising to see such a discrepancy in that specific income range. I don't have any specific insight to it, but my guess is that that's a cohort of people that probably bought in the most to President Trump's arguments about the economy and the stock market and believing they would benefit the most under Trump presidency. That's just a guess on my part, though.
Sure. Like everything today, all of this could change. We'll keep reporting the latest as it comes in. That's Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
The results of many contests, including the race for president, might hinge on legal challenges. And for that, let's bring in Edward Foley. He's director of election law at Ohio State Moritz College of Law. And welcome to the show.
Good to be with you. Thanks.
Yeah, so we've been expecting election lawsuits if the results were close, and they certainly are. What states are you watching for legal challenges in?
Oh, Pennsylvania, number one. There's also a lawsuit in Nevada. You know, new suits could materialize in any of the battleground states. It's still early in the process, actually.
Yeah, very early in the process, but we've actually seen some of those lawsuits come to fruition. Republicans in Pennsylvania alleged a county board of elections there improperly opened and inspected mail ballots received before Tuesday. And then, as you mentioned, Nevada's highest court rejected a Republican attempt to halt processing of mail ballots. But have you seen anything so far with the potential to ultimately determine any key election results, knowing that we're very early in this process?
No, not yet. I mean, and that is the key point. I mean, you can file a lawsuit, but it doesn't mean you win. And in order to make it affect the outcome of the election, it's got to affect enough ballots. And we're still, as you say, early in the counting of the votes. So we don't know if the margin of victory in some of these states is going to be 100,000 or 10,000 or 1,000. And those orders of magnitude really make a difference because how many ballots are you litigating over? The number of ballots you may be complaining about may be much smaller than the final margin of victory.
Right, because we're still waiting on millions of ballots to be counted. How long are you expecting it to take to find out who ultimately won this presidential race? Of course, it's the question of the day. We're all waiting.
Right. Well, it takes stages. You know, I think there's sort of three parts to the process. First is the media and the networks that make their projections. And we've seen that, although, again, some of the states still haven't been called. But then it's the candidates who react to that. And until you get a concession speech from a candidate, the race still is in play. And obviously, in the presidential race, the two candidates are very much vying to win. So for that, you have to let the legal process run its course. And you know, there's still many days on the clock for that. I mean, we want results now, but from a federal law perspective in the presidential race, you're not looking until December until final answers.
Let's talk a little bit about Wisconsin. So Trump's campaign manager says that Wisconsin is headed to recount territory. We know that they've been there before. What are the rules governing recounts there?
Yeah, well, every state does it a little bit differently. And I think the key to understand about a recount is at that point, you really are recounting ballots that have already been counted. And so if your tabulation equipment is working properly, you know, the recount numbers usually are pretty close to the initial numbers. You know, one big point I think worth mentioning is nothing has emerged that's the equivalent of the hanging chads.
Yes.
You know, this year, we remember that from 2000. Now, that's not to say something couldn't crop up, but right now, there isn't anything that seems to be the hanging chad of this year.
Yeah, take us back there to 2000, Florida hanging chad situation, and how different we are from there. Because that's really, for those who were in the thick of it during that time, it's really the only one that we can reference that feels at all similar, but then not.
Right. Well, you know, one thing about 2000 was it was Florida, Florida, Florida. It came down to that pivotal state. We don't even know if that's going to be the case with the presidential election this year. You know, there's enough fluidity in enough states that, you know, we don't know if there's just going to be one single state that becomes the focal point. It could be Pennsylvania, but maybe not. So that's a difference. The other difference is, again, the reason why, you know, Florida went to court for so long is that the certified margin ended up being just 537 votes out of 6 million cast. I mean, that's a tiny, that people talked about that as a statistical tie. You know, if Wisconsin, for example, today is 20,000 votes apart, that's very close, but that's not 537 votes. So numbers really matter. And then again, Florida had a lot of problems. There was the butterfly ballot that people focused on initially. That went by the wayside. And then everybody talked about the hanging chads. You know, nothing has quite come into focus as the single basis of litigation this year.
Yeah. What should our listeners know about election law governing the counting of votes and how that could affect the outcome of the presidential race? Because, you know, we keep hearing about a lot of these lawsuits. We know there are thousands of lawyers just standing by. I know many of them are small and non-consequential, but it still says something.
Yeah, although I think I mean, they are there and the lawyers are want to litigate, but again, they may not make a difference in the end, because what may matter is just all the ballots. As you say, there are millions of ballots to be counted. These are valid ballots. A lot of them arrived, you know, well before yesterday, Election Day. In some of these states, they couldn't be processed until Election Day, or in Michigan the day before. So it's just local officials getting through the pile of ballots that are entitled to be counted. And, you know, there may be nothing to fight about it, because by law, they deserve to be counted and will be counted.
You're in Ohio. Were you surprised at all by the election results in your state? President Trump won it in 2016, and he won it pretty handily again.
Yeah, for a little while last night, Ohio looked like it may be, you know, different than it was 4 years ago, but it ended up, as you say, where it was. That just shows how, while we're all glued to the computers or the TV or the radio or wherever, getting the one in the latest numbers, we do need patience, and we just have to wait for the votes to actually be counted. And because what it looks like at the beginning is not necessarily what it looks like at the end of the process.
That's Edward Foley, Director of Election Law at Ohio State Moritz College of Law. Thank you so much. Well, among the states we're watching today as they count ballots, some of the so-called blue wall states, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, for the last 25 years, Michigan had reliably voted for the Democratic presidential candidate. That was until 2016, when President Trump won by just over 10,000 votes, less than half a percentage point. Let's see how things are shaping up there now. We have with us Michigan Radio Zoe Clark, who joins us now from Ann Arbor. Hey, Zoe.
Hey, Tanya.
So Michigan Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson said she expects all votes to be counted by tonight. What's the status of the count so far?
Right. So we just heard from her a little while ago, and there's about 100,000 still outstanding ballots that need to be counted throughout the state. And she said, interestingly enough, that a lot of those are coming from cities, Democratic-leaning cities like Detroit and Grand Rapids.
Are those the specific areas, the cities that you're watching for? And I'm thinking about some of the really important counties as well.
Absolutely. I know you know Michigan well, and so we're definitely keeping an eye on Wayne County, which is where Detroit is, Macomb County, which of course is, you know, home of the Reagan Democrats, and then Kent County, which is where the city of Grand Rapids is on the west side of the state.
100,000 ballots, that's what you said, right? 100,000 ballots.
Yep.
Michigan voters approved no reason absentee ballot voting in the state in 2018, and this is the first presidential election where it's been used. Tell us a little bit more about the turnout in the state, both in person and by mail.
Yeah, absolutely. Historic turnout. This was the first presidential race. It's really sort of apples to oranges if you look at the absentee ballot numbers, but over 3 million returned absentee ballot votes, and then another more than 2 million who showed up at the polls. So we are already above the historic turnout that Barack Obama saw in Michigan in 2008 and still counting from there.
Okay, 2008 Obama, but 2016 Trump won by a razor thin margin. As I mentioned, just over 10,000 votes. There was a recount in the state requested by Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate back then. With the minute I have with you, do you think a very close margin this year will lead to legal action and a recount?
It certainly could. We just heard from President Trump that it looks like they are already talking about a recount in Wisconsin, of course, Michigan's neighbor. So it's something that we'll have to wait and see. But I can tell you the Secretary of State, Jocelyn Benson, part of what is taking so much time is that this is a very, very thorough count. And she said she's ready to have it stand up against any legal challenges from either side, I should say, of the political spectrum.
That's Michigan Radio's program director, Zoe Clark. As always, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tanya. Great to talk to you as always.
Well, no matter the results of the election, today is the day the U.S. leaves the Paris Climate Accord. Now, you might have thought that the U.S. was already long gone. President Trump announced he was taking the country out in 2017. But today is the day the U.S. actually becomes the first of 200 countries to walk away from this combined effort to reduce greenhouse gases and slow down climate change. So what does this mean? Let's bring in Rachel Cletus, Policy Director for the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And Rachel, under the Trump administration, the U.S. never would have met any of the commitments from the Paris Climate Accord anyway, because it was going in the other direction, rolling things back, right?
Absolutely. We've seen just an extraordinary rollback of any climate-related policies under this administration. And this exit from the Paris Agreement that became final today is it's just a shameful act. And it's especially cruel coming at a time when here in the U.S. and around the world, we're seeing an increasing spate of devastating climate-related disasters, most recently Super Typhoon Goni and Hurricane Eta. But we've had a terribly destructive hurricane and wildfire season this year in the U.S. that has devastated communities.
Well, what we're also seeing today is a country that is rigidly divided. And speak to those on the side of Donald Trump who would say, you know, put aside those who would doubt that people have any impact on climate change, but those who would say it's just too expensive. We can't afford the kinds of rollbacks and curbings of emission that the pact would have called for. It's just too harmful to our economy.
Look, what we really can't afford is runaway climate change. This year in 2020 alone, we've seen more than 16 extreme weather events that have caused $1 billion each. They've led to nearly 200 deaths, often communities of color and low-income communities bearing the brunt of these events. What I want to say very clearly is that the political issues aside, the election results are not certain yet. The scientific realities haven't changed. The science about climate change is getting increasingly dire, and projections show that they will worsen considerably unless we make deep cuts in global heat-trapping emissions.
Yeah. Let's say Joe Biden is elected. He has said he'll get the U.S. back in the climate agreement on day one. Is it that easy?
At this point, even this current administration can walk us back from the brink. A nation can rejoin the Paris Agreement by just giving 30 days' notice. But clearly, the track record of this administration doesn't give one much hope. If there were to be a Biden administration, there's no doubt that the U.S. will rejoin the Paris Agreement in 2021, and it must do so with enhanced ambition in its climate commitments.
Well, and then staying with the Trump administration, there have been climate deniers appointed to top positions in scientific agencies, the president himself dismissing, you know, established climate science. What's your biggest concern from a climate perspective if he is reelected?
My biggest concern is really for the well-being of people, because, again, regardless of the political stance that this administration has taken, where it has chosen to undermine every single climate policy, censor federal government scientists, try to censor reports, basically try to stymie climate action on every front and prop up fossil fuel interests. That doesn't change the fact that climate change is here and now, and people are being really hard hit already. Mm. So it's incumbent on not just the president and the administration, but also Congress to step up and act in the best interests of people.
And just a last question, if it is President Biden who, again, wants to rejoin the Paris Accord, what's the clock? You know, what do people think is the clock, the amount of time we have, and particularly the U.S., which is the biggest emitter of greenhouse gases, what amount of time do we have to start trying to turn around the Titanic?
It's well past time for our nation to pivot away from being part of the problem and towards contributing a leading share of the solution. So we have to step up very quickly. We have to make up for lost time. And we have to do it in a way that centers equity and justice. So addresses the concerns of coal workers and coal communities that are being harmed by the shift away from coal, addresses the environmental justice concerns of fence line and frontline communities that have borne the brunt of pollution from our dependence on fossil fuels.
Fence line, they're living with the emitters. Rachel Cletus, Policy Director for the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, thank you.
Thank you so much, Robin.
So, it's the day the U.S. leaves the Paris Climate Accords. It's the day after Election Day. Let's recap. Votes still being counted. Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Nevada, and Arizona, Alaska also haven't been called yet. President Trump and Joe Biden both have a narrow path to victory. Biden's is a little less rocky, a little wider, but still tough. Looks like Republicans will hold on to the Senate. Democrats lost some seats but are still the majority in the House. We're going to be on this story all day, Here and Now. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.